it's popular to show that you have dominance over the truth. That's what an authoritarian does. So the media kept on waiting for him to be punished for that. But his supporters are attracted by that. The supporters are attracted by his open defiance of reality.
That is Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley here on Radio Boston 2 weeks after Donald Trump's inauguration in 2017. He was speaking about the authoritarian threats that he perceived then to our Democratic Republic. Well, it's been a heck of a 4 years, and since then we've seen numerous deliberate falsehoods from the White House. We saw the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. We saw the 2019 straight pride parade here in Boston. And of course, the violent pro-Trump insurrection at the U.S. Capitol earlier this month, which we were talking about with U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling before the break. So in these waning hours of the Trump administration, we wanted to check back in. We wanted to bring Professor Jason Stanley back and see how his analysis stood up over the last 4 years. Professor Jason Stanley is the author of a number of books, including How Propaganda Works and How Fascism Works. Professor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much. It's good to be speaking here after 4 years.
So, yes, 4 years. I'm just going to ask you straight up. Do you think you were right? And how right were you?
I think that I accurately assessed the situation. I think it was problematic that people didn't see that analysis until very recently. And we've normalized so much. I mean, if you think about what we've normalized, it's shocking in retrospect. I mean, that interview 4 years ago was before the Muslim travel ban went through the Supreme Court. It was before the child separations, and it was before the horrific, narrowly politicized response to COVID, when the president and his entire administration said, we don't care because it's affecting Democratic-run states, and so it's not our problem. So, and then on top of it, culminated by what happened on January 6th and the post-election fiascos, where the president tried to annul the results of a free and fair election.
Now, we've bracketed this conversation sort of just now and in my introduction around the Trump administration, but I do want to ask you, because what you've just said is quite damning of that administration. Were we headed in this direction prior to 2016? Were there larger forces at play?
Yes. I mean, as someone who studies the rise of authoritarian fascist movements, the sort of devaluing of the elite classes, the failures by the Democrats and the Republicans to address America's problems, the yawning inequalities, it allowed someone like Trump to come and say, they've ignored you. The system is rigged and corrupt. The financial crisis, the Iraq war. This allows for positive social change, these terrible failings of the entire elite political class. But history tells us again and again, it also allows for really grim responses to our national problems. And if we do that again, if too many Americans become convinced that the government is in the hands of wealthy elites, which of course it is to some extent. But unless we address that, then we open ourselves up to this again. And of course, unless we address our horrific racial problem with racial injustice, where under Democratic presidents, Republican presidents, no matter what the administration, Black Americans are rightly protesting brutal treatment by a militarized police, that enables demagogues to come and say, I am your law and order president who will take care of the problem. From Nixon to Trump, they have done that. So unless we deal with these terrible inequities, racial and economic, we're going to go through this again.
So let me make sure, let me kind of feedback to you what I think I'm hearing from you. It's a combination of institutions failing people, people feeling disenfranchised, deep tensions along identity such as race, deep economic inequality, you're saying that those create an opportunity for someone who is despotic and may lean toward fascism or authoritarianism to claim a place and become a leader. Am I understanding you correctly?
Absolutely. And on top of that, we have multiple generations of the Republican Party that have sort of leaned into anti-democracy. They've lost 7 out of 8 of the last presidential elections, the popular vote. And each time they've done that, they've been fine with it. And their response has been to lean into voter disenfranchisement by fraudulent claims of voter fraud and such like. And if you do that, if you play the anti-democratic game, you're also opening yourself up to someone who comes, hey, you know, I'm just going to be anti-democratic. Why do we have to even pretend that this is a democracy? And once we see figures like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz do this, who have no excuse. I mean, these
senators from Missouri and Texas who joined in the questioning of, just for our listeners, joined in the questioning of the legality of the results last week. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, and that's a very concerning development because, I mean, Ted Cruz went to Princeton and Harvard. Josh Hawley's a banker's son who went to Stanford and Yale Law School. These are not just elites. These are elites of the elites. I mean, I went to the State University of New York at Stony Brook. I mean, these are hyper elites, and they're going in for this. So that is concerning.
You're leaning in hard, and I understand that. It does make me want to raise a couple of things. We do have an electoral college. Yes, we had presidents who lost popular votes. They did win the electoral college vote until this time when we had a challenging of the electoral college by Republicans directly. And I recognize and I acknowledge that. But I find myself thinking about the emergence of some of the leaders that President Trump has admired in other countries. So maybe a Bolsonaro in Brazil, a Duterte in the Philippines. There wasn't a U.S. Republican Party in those countries, and yet we've seen this emergence other places. So how do we tell that story to ourselves, and what are those larger phenomena? I wonder if we are a global community at risk here.
You're making a great point. It's really vital to see how badly the brand of democracy has been harmed by the developments in the United States. I mean, Trump's allies and friends, Erdogan, Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro has said the other day that it's up to the military to decide whether Brazil is going to be a democracy or a dictatorship. He's leaving it up to the military. So, I mean, he's being very open, the Trump of the tropics, as he's called. And he imitated Trump's response on COVID, resulting in the second highest death toll in the world behind the United States. So Trump's open anti-democratic antics have correlated with a far-right international movement. And this was enabled to some extent by a failure to sort of crack down on this with, say, Modi in Brazil, in India, the Prime Minister of India, who Obama was not harsh enough with, so who's also an authoritarian ethno-nationalist, religious nationalist. So we have these movements all across the world. And when the United States has always, of course, been hypocritical about its democracy. I mean, we've only been a real democracy since the 1960s, or only been a democracy.
Wait, what makes you say that?
Well, Black Americans were not allowed to vote until the 1960s in the South. And so you're not a democracy if a huge part of your population is not allowed access to the ballot. We were a heron folk democracy, a democracy that constrains the vote to certain populations. So,
you feel we've overcome that today?
Well, I think that Black Americans have pushed us to be more and more democratic, from the civil rights movement to what we saw in Georgia with Stacey Abrams and others registering so many voters. But we have an enormous movement that became explicit to disenfranchise Black voters. That's what the president was talking about when he blamed his loss on Detroit, Atlanta, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, you know, cities with large Black or majority Black populations. So So there's a push within the Republican Party that has become explicit. It wasn't this explicit before. People are very explicit. The more people vote, the less chance we will have to retain power. And so I want a Republican Party and I want a conservative movement that repudiates those anti-democratic tendencies. We're so much better as a country when we all commit despite our differences, to negotiating together and allowing everyone to have our voice. And unfortunately, we have this incredibly strong anti-democratic movement that's laced through with the idea that Black voters are not legitimate voters. And that concerns me.
As I was preparing for our conversation today, I happened to notice a tweet that was posted on the account of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today. And in part, it said, quote, censorship, wokeness, political correctness, it all points in one direction, authoritarianism cloaked as moral righteousness, end quote. I'm sure you are aware that there are those who would argue that there's authoritarianism coming from the left as well. How would you address that argument?
I would address that argument by pointing out, of course, everyone on every political stage of every political ideology is going to be annoying in various respects and involve themselves in excesses. And I condemn excesses when they appear. However, we have to be incredibly aware that the claim that there's left authoritarianism is what the far right always says. So I think we should be vigilant about free speech and academic freedom. However, we should also be vigilant about the fact that the way that the far right comes to power is by pretending that there is a left authoritarianism that they're saving us from. And the fact that that you get criticized if you say something Penguin Random House removes a contract from Josh Hawley, that's not left authoritarianism. Being criticized, that's free speech. People are allowed to criticize you. That's just how it works. If you say something that someone thinks is racist, they're allowed to say that's racist, and you're allowed to defend yourself. And capitalism works by private companies deciding what's in their best interests. And what we've had is we've had private companies make brand decisions. I'm the first person to criticize the excesses of capitalism. But the last thing, so if the Republicans have a problem with capitalism, I mean, you know, I understand capitalism can be rough sometimes, but, you know, they're the ones who are saying this should be the only system. And the way capitalism works is that, you know, if a corporation thinks you're not helping their brand, they're going to disassociate from you.
And to that point, I do want to note our team is telling me that it was actually Simon and Schuster that canceled Josh Hawley's book.
Simon and Schuster.
All right. Just to correct the record. So listen, we have about 30 seconds left. What is one thing that neighbor to neighbor we can do as residents of the Commonwealth and of New England to improve the moment we're in?
I think we can try to get over these divisions. We can try to recognize that we have a lot of work as a country to do, and we do not want to get in a situation where we view our political opponents as mortal threats and danger. And there's going to be social conservatives, there's going to be liberals, progressives, and we all should commit to every one of us having a democratic voice and to working together to try to address collectively the problems we face, which are COVID, inequality, and racial injustice, among others.
And that is Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of a number of books, including How Fascism Works and How Propaganda Works. Thank you for bookending these 4 years with us, Professor Stanley. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.